We must go back, brother and sister, into Gethsemane, and we do so by going to Matthew and chapter 26, albeit very briefly. Matthew 26, and Judas and those with him come into the garden, and in verse 47 we read they have swords and staves. And there was a great multitude. We'll see how great in another verse. A great multitude with swords and staves. And in verse 49 we read, and he forthwith he came to Jesus and said, "Hail, Master," and kissed him. The very first kiss in Scripture was deceptive. And so is this. Jesus said unto him, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" Now, as was often the case with the Master, when he asked a question, it wasn't that he might find out the answer, because he already knew. Quite often they were designed to make the people who should have been answering think about their answer and maybe change their mind. So this was Judas's last chance then for repentance. But he calls him friend, which perhaps isn't the first word that would come to our mind, except that I believe the Master was quoting from the Psalms. Psalm 41 and verse 9. Psalm 41 and verse 9. "Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread," which of course Judas had done a few hours before, "hath lifted up his heel against me." And we know that this is taken up as a prophecy to do with Judas, because it's quoted in John chapter 13 and verse 18. And so the Master has already quoted that, and it's still on his mind, and so he addresses Judas as friend. The word friend doesn't mean, not a particularly a term of endearment, it simply means someone who is already known. And so this dark and evil process begins, and we pick up the details in John now. We'll spend a little time now in John and chapter 18. John 18, where in verse 2 we see that Judas arrives, or has covenanted to do so. In verse 3, Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests. Now that word "band" is actually a technical term. If it was a Roman band, the word, it's a cohort, which is a technical Roman term, and literally it is the tenth part of a legion. Now a legion, I understand, could be anything between 3,000 and 6,000 men. So logically, therefore, if this is the tenth part, this can be anything between 300 and 600. If this term is being used in that technical Roman sense. Now this wasn't a Roman army, and therefore we're not necessarily at liberty to make that assumption. But we've already seen in Matthew that it was a great multitude. So either way then, it was this large company of men. We've seen the swords and the staves. But now we read in verse 3, at the end of the verse, "They came hither with lanterns and torches and weapons." The light of the world had been with them for 3.5 years. And they were so blind they couldn't see that he was the light of the world. And they came to find him with their man-made torches and lanterns. The irony is hard to miss. And so Jesus, then knowing all things, said, "Whom seek ye?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he said unto them, "I am he." And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. We'll come back to that stood with them in a moment. And as he had said unto them, I am he, they went backward and fell to the ground. There has been a previous time in Scripture when something probably had legs, and fell to the ground. It was the serpent. And here these people, who are of course the seed of the serpent, are now reduced to squirming upon the ground like the seed of the serpent that they are, or that they were. And it's almost comical, if it wasn't so desperately serious. There they were, squirming on the ground, and Jesus of course is still standing up. And so he asks the other question. Look, just imagine, he's looking down upon them, and they're all looking up at him. And he says, who did you say you were looking for? Then they have to say again, Jesus of Nazareth. And he's demonstrated his power, but I don't believe that's why he did it. Well, we know that's not why, because we read on. Jesus answered, said, I have told you that I am he. If you seek me, let these go their way. Remember, he instructed them to pray that they might not enter into temptation or trial or testing. And so Jesus now, in effect, is keeping the soldiers on the ground and letting the disciples go. And so when he says then, in verse 9, that the saying might be fulfilled, which he spake, of them which thou gavest me have I lost none, he's actually quoting from his own prayer back in chapter 17 and verse 12. So he's allowed them to escape. Certainly to escape the being taken by this band of men. And in verse 10, Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. And the servant's name was Malchus. Why are we given that little piece of information that his name was Malchus? Well, it's the word king, as in Melchizedek. And he was the servant of the priest. So here was a man whose name was King, who was the servant of the priest. And there is this little link of servant of priest. But of course there was nothing righteous about them. Nothing righteous whatsoever. But he was a servant. And perhaps there's that little link between with what Jesus had previously done and the foot washing. Here was the servant, that servant of the priest whose name was a king. But let's just very briefly think about Peter. We know that Peter followed them. We see in verse 15, Simon Peter followed Jesus. So did the other disciple, which we take to be John. And they were able to get into the palace of the priest. And we know of the denials. And the cock crew, we read in verse 27. And then we know that he wept bitterly. And rather than being anxious to criticise Peter, is there any one of us that can say, in all honesty, that we have never been in that situation, that we have never, in some form, denied our master? Have we never just kept quiet when we should have spoken about something? In whatever circumstance, that means different things to all one, each of us. But we've all, I would suspect, in some way or other, at some time or other, done what Peter did. But did we weep about it afterwards? Did we weep bitterly? Or was it just one of those things and we shrug our shoulders and we move on and forget it? Peter wept because he had denied his master. And when we miss that mark, we too should weep. Just draw one attention to perhaps what we might say was a mistake of Peter's. It's in verse 18. At the end of the verse, Peter stood with them, that is to say, the servants and the officers. It was the cool of the evening, and they were warming themselves by the fire, we read. And so Peter stood with them and warmed himself. He stood with them. It would have been better, of course, had he not stood with them. He would have not have put himself in that position of denial then in the first place. But just link that across with verse 5. Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. It's the same phrase, certainly in the English, it's the same. But there is there an exhortation, isn't there, brethren and sisters, with whom we stand, with whom we have to do. Psalm 1, isn't it? Let's have just a glance at Psalm 1. Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. I'm sure we're all aware there's that progression, isn't there, of walking, standing, sitting. And here, Peter was in that middle stage, wasn't he? He was standing with the sinners. And because he was with them, it enabled them to challenge him. And he denied. So we move on then, or at least we go back now. That's all we're going to deal with, Peter. Go back in time then, so to speak, into John and verse 12. The band and the captain, the officers of the Jews, took Jesus and bound him and led him away to Annas first. Annas meaning Yah has favoured. What a denial of the meaning of his name. I believe I'm right in saying that we know nothing of the trial. It wasn't a trial really, an interrogation of Annas. I think the details that we have are the trial to do with Caiaphas. And we move on then into verse 14. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. In other words, he'd already pronounced the verdict some time before. And so, as is often the case with political trials, which is all it was, it was just for show. They were casting around, trying to find some sort of witness, as we shall see. But just glance back at chapter 11 and verse 50 and see what he said. He couldn't have got it more wrong if he'd tried. 11 and verse 50. Nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not. And yet, because of what they were doing, the nation was going to perish, in the sense that it would perish off the land. But he had made his mind up, and now here he was, the high priest, at least in name, and he'd already made his mind up. And so we move now to verse 19. The high priest, so we're still with Caiaphas, he was high priest that year, we know, asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Now think about that. Jesus had been preaching for 3.5 years. He'd spent some time in Jerusalem. And now Caiaphas asks him of his doctrine. And so we can see why Jesus says, I spake openly to the world, I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, in secret have I said nothing, why askest thou me? Ask them. Now that was a correct thing for Jesus to say, because under the law, the witnesses should have brought an accusation. And the priest should have heard the witnesses, and then examined the accused. They haven't bothered with that. They're trying to go straight to Jesus and again trick him into saying something that they might have a case. So they're going completely against their own law. And as a result of this response in verse 22, when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand. And it's not altogether clear from the Greek whether it's the palm of his hand or with a rod. And we won't look at it, but it may be a fulfilment of Micah chapter 5 and verse 1, but we must press on. We turn now for a while into Luke. So we go now to Luke's Gospel, and chapter 22. But just thinking of that beating when it started. Remember, we're still with Caiaphas, the son-in-law of Annas. And remember what we said on Monday, speaking of the house of Annas. Their sons-in-law, which Caiaphas was, are guardians of the temple. Their servants beat the people with staves. So this was nothing new. They did it all the time. Usually it was to extract money, we presume. But now they were beating Jesus. But we'll get more detail in Luke 22 when we look now at verse 63. We're still with Caiaphas. The men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him, and when they had blindfolded him, they struck him upon the face. And smote there, they smote him in verse 63, is to flay, or to scourge, or to thrash. This was an evil circumstance, brethren and sisters. This wasn't just the odd blow. And this is before it got to Pilate, remember, and to Herod. This is still with the priests. So they flayed him or scourged him. And when they had blindfolded him, they struck him. And that, of course, is standard torture practice. To blindfold someone so they don't know when or if a blow is coming. And we read they struck him upon the face. And the word there means to thump or to pummel, usually with a stick. So we're back with the staves of the sons of Annas. And the force behind the word is that it is repeated. So this went on and on. Now by now, I guess we're in the small hours of the night. If they entered Gethsemane around about midnight-ish, maybe 2 or 3 hours even in the garden, would now be, say, something in the order of 3 o'clock in the morning. He's already been to Annas, now he's come to Caiaphas, so maybe we're on towards 4. Doesn't really matter the timing, except to say, verse 66 says, as soon as it was day. And so whatever the time was, the implication is that this beating, this thrashing and flaying and blindfold beating went on through the small hours to the dawn. And remember, he's still with the Jews. He hasn't got to the Romans yet. This was a terrible time, brethren and sisters. And yes, it's unpleasant to ponder it, but it's part of the sacrifice which he made that we might live. And so we should ponder it from time to time. So verse 66, as soon as it was day, the elders and the people and the priests and the scribes came together, and they led him away to their council. So this is now with the Sanhedrin. This is the last of the Jewish so-called trials. They've all been illegal so far, and so is this. Caiaphas was the president of the Sanhedrin by virtue of office. I couldn't help but smile when I read that phrase. There was no virtue in either him or his office. But he was there by virtue of office. So they took him to the full Sanhedrin. And now again, they're trying to find witnesses, as we know, and they couldn't find any to agree. And in verse 60, verse 69, towards the end of verse 69, shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand in the power of God? And Matthew and Mark add the phrase, coming in clouds of heaven. I believe is a straight reference to AD 70. So again, he was telling them, if they had but the wit to realise, that what they were bringing upon themselves was their own destruction. And because he mentioned the Son of God, at last they'd got what they thought was the evidence. And they said, what further need have we for witnesses? So they've abandoned the Hebrew system of law. For witnesses to come forward. Don't need them anymore. They've got him, so they think. We have heard him out of his own mouth. And so then, they bring him to Pilate. We go back now into John 18 again. John 18, and we come into verse 28. And when they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the hall of judgment, and it was early, they themselves went not to the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, they might not eat the Passover. Hypocrisy on a grand scale. They've been plotting murder for many months. They'd now brought this plot to a conclusion. They'd beaten and thrashed him. They'd blindfolded him. They'd tortured him. They were intent on murder of an innocent man. Oh, but no, they couldn't cross over the threshold. They might be unclean. Can't do that. Breathtaking hypocrisy. But brethren and sisters, take the exhortation. We're all capable of thinking one thing and doing another. We are all capable of amazing inconsistencies. So yes, we do condemn him absolutely. Take the exhortation, each one of us. Raises the question then, because it was so early, why was Pilate up and about, and why was he already there so early? The suggestion is often made, without a great deal of proof, but it may be right, that there was a prearranged meeting. They'd already teed Pilate up because they needed the stamp of his authority for a capital offence. And so the suggestion is made that he was up and ready and waiting for them to come. And that does also explain when Pilate asks the question, what accusation? And again, that was part of Roman law. There had to be an accusation. They give this rather petulant answer. Well, if he wasn't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him. As if to say, we should already know. This is already sorted. Don't bother with the details. Just let us get on with it. Maybe that's evidence for this collusion beforehand. It matters little, quite honestly. So he wants the accusation. Now, we're not going to spend too much time with the trials, because we need, obviously, to get on to more important things. So they've brought him to Pilate, and they've tried to put forward some sort of case, but only half-heartedly. I'm going to go back into Luke now, into chapter 23, because it's only Luke that tells us of the visit to Herod. Luke 23 and verse 8, where we read there, verse 7, when he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was at Jerusalem at the time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was glad, and he wanted a miracle to be done. But Jesus, on this occasion, and others, in fulfilment of the prophet Isaiah, answered him, not a word, as a sheep before the shearers is dumb. Just in passing, of course, Jesus wasn't literally dumb throughout throughout his trials, but he never offered anything in defence of himself, I think is the meaning there. But on this occasion, he answered him nothing. And so in verse 11, Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught, meaning to utterly despise. And they mocked him, to jeer, to deride. And they arrayed him in a gorgeous robe. What an irony. That word gorgeous there is exactly the same as the word white in the Apocalypse chapter 19 and verse 8. The white robe of the bride. Clean linen, clean and white. I forget the phrase, but you know where I am. The righteousness of saints. And here, these wicked people have put on this robe of righteousness, so to speak. And very quickly, if not already, it would be covered in his own blood. And so they put on him the gorgeous robe. And so, I'm sorry, but we've got to go back to John chapter 19. Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. Don't gloss over that verse. He's already been beaten and flayed by the Jews. We're now with the Romans, and they scourged him. And it was a terrible thing. Little bits of metal or bone were embedded into the thongs of the whip, and there were several strands to that whip. And the victim was caused to bend down so that his back was exposed. And a Roman soldier would come and with all his might and vindictiveness would bring that scourge down into the back of the victim. And those hard pieces of bone or whatever would dig in and tear the flesh. And the blood would pour out. I know many of you have been with me here before, but Isaiah 50 and verse 6. Isaiah 50 and verse 6. I gave my back to the smiters. They didn't have to tie him down. I gave my back to the smiters. And then a piece of information we're not given in the Gospels. And my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame. Excuse me, from shame and spitting. So they pulled the hair off his face, they spat at him, and he gave his back to the smiters. Now, while we're considering this, can we go to Psalm 129 and verse 3? Think of those thongs landing upon the flesh of his back. Psalm 129, verse 3. The ploughers ploughed upon my back. They made long their furrows. So next time you're out in the country and you see the plough digging into the soil, turning it over, think of this verse. And remember, it was done for you. The ploughers ploughed upon my back. They made long their furrows. Into verse 2, we're back into John 19. And the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns. The thorns, of course, take us back into Genesis 3. And they cursed upon the ground that he brought forth the thorns and the thistles. So they made a crown of thorns and they put it upon his head. And the word means to impose. The word actually means to impose in either a friendly or a hostile way. It's pretty obvious, of course, this was hostile. So this wasn't just placed gently upon his head. This crown of thorns would have been jammed onto his skull. And as you know, there are many blood vessels in the scalp, and just the slightest cut on the scalp brings forth a great deal of blood. So now just imagine this picture. His back has been torn to shreds. Blood would now pour down his face. It's a dreadful and awful thing to contemplate. But it should make us think, and make us think about ourselves and relationship to it. And they put on him another robe. More pain. Taking one robe off and another robe on. And his back would be totally exposed and painful. And in verse 5, then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns. Wearing the crown of thorns. Remember that. It's an important little detail. And the purple robe. And Pilate said unto them, behold the man. At least that's what it says in the Authorised Version. You may notice that the phrase Pilate, or the word Pilate, is in italics. So we might read that. Then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown and the robe, and said unto them, behold the man. In other words, I'm suggesting it was he that said that. And I think we go to Zechariah and chapter 6. A crown of thorns. Desperately painful, desperately mocking. But where did the mind of the master go? Zechariah and chapter 6. And we'll pick up verse 11. Then take silver and gold and make crowns and set them upon the head of Joshua. Of Yahshua. So he was a Yahshua with a crown set upon his head. The son of Josedek, the high priest. And he was the priest going about his priestly duty, as we saw before. Thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, behold the man. His name is the branch. He shall go up out of his place. He shall build the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh. And he shall bear the glory and sit and rule upon his throne. And in verse 15, we go on to read. And they that are far off shall come and build the temple of Yahweh. And ye shall know that Yahweh of hosts hath sent me unto you. And that was the one thing they couldn't grasp. The Jews would not understand that he was the Son of God. But they'd understand when Yahweh of hosts came in AD 70. And so we would suggest that his mind has gone to that verse. We move back into John now, and we want to go into verse 14. It was the preparation, so we're still on the 14th of the month, and it was about the sixth hour, so we're now at midday. And he said unto the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him, crucify him. And Pilate said unto them, shall I crucify your king? And the chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And was this again another of those remarks that the Father caused to be uttered so that the Son might pick them up with his spiritual mind? I'm going to Hosea and chapter 10. Well, chapter 9 first. Hosea and chapter 9. They have just said, we have no king. Well, we'll go to chapter 10, verse 3, just to make the connection. Chapter 10, verse 3, for now they shall say, we have no king. Why? Because we feared not Yahweh, which of course was exactly the circumstance of the priests. But just look around this verse and see what we see. Chapter 9 and verse 12. Though they bring up their children, yet will I bereave them, that there will be not a man left. Yea, woe also to them when I depart from them. Bereaved of children. Just bear that verse in mind. We'll pick it up in a moment. Verse 16. Ephraim is smitten, their root is dried up. We're back with the fig tree. Their root is dried up. They shall bear no fruit with the fig tree. Yea, though they bring forth, yet will I slay the beloved fruit of their womb. My God will cast them away because they did not hearken. Again, AD 70. Just bear those phrases in mind. And also, chapter 10 now, and verse 8. The high places of Avon, the sin of Israel shall be destroyed, the thorn and the thistle, wearing a crown of thorns, the thorn and the thistle shall come upon their altars. They shall say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. Now we've picked up several verses there, and now we'll see why. Come with me now, please. Back into Luke again, Luke 23. That thought process which started with, we have no king. He would have been aware, surely, of those verses to which we've just drawn attention. And Luke 23, and he's now bearing his stake in verse 26. And verse 27, the women bewail him in verse 27. But Jesus turned unto them and said, Daughters of Jerusalem. We haven't got time, but that phrase comes 7 times in the Song of Solomon. And obviously it's to do with the bride, but we must pass on. Weep not for me, weep for yourselves and for your children. Remember his mind, he's in Hosea, about being bereft of their children. The days are coming when they will say, Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bear, and so on. Verse 30, Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us. So we know he's in Hosea, straight out of Hosea 10. Then they shall begin to say, Fall on us, and to the hills cover us. And if they do these things in the green tree, what shall be done in the dry? Back with the fig tree again. The dry tree that was cursed. That's a quotation from Ezekiel 20 and verse 47, but we'll leave you to follow that through for yourselves. Verse 33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him. Remember the physical agony that he would be in any way. He was already very weak, in a great deal of pain. They now lay him down upon that accursed tree. They put nails through his hands and his feet. They raise him up into an upright position, and I guess none too gently drop it into a hole. Pain would be indescribable. But his mind is astonishingly clear. The first of the quotations or the sayings which Jesus then makes upon this stake is in verse 34. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Forgive who? Forgive, I would suggest, the Romans. To them it was just another crucifixion. They did them all day, every day. The Jews knew exactly what they were doing. We'll come back into Luke, but come to the Psalms, please. Psalm 69. We'll also come back into Psalm 69. Psalm 69, and just a quick glance at verse 26. For they persecuted him whom thou hast smitten. They talk to the grief of those whom thou hast wounded. Add iniquity to their iniquity. Let them not come to thy righteousness. Let them be blotted out of the book of the living and not be written in the book of the righteous. So there is a condemnation of those who knew what they were doing. But the Roman soldiers, we would suggest, he prays for and says, Forgive them, for they know not what they do. And then we read that they parted his raiment and cast lots, and the people stood beholding. And Matthew records, we won't go to it, but Matthew 27 and verse 43 records the people saying, If he is the Christ, let him come down. So we have these three elements, the garments, the people, and the if he be the Christ. And these are all allusions and references to Psalm 22 this time. Psalm 22. Where in verse 18 we read, They part my garments among them and cast my lots. Arranged by the Father, perhaps. They might remember this psalm. And verse 17, they looked upon him. Verse 17 says, I may tell my bones, they look and stare upon me. Picked up in Luke 23. And of course, verse 16, they have pierced my hands and my feet. And the last few verses of the psalm. for the kingdom is Yahweh's. He is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon the earth shall eat and worship. They shall go down as the dust before it and bow him, and so on. I'm sure the mind of the master went from one end to the other of this psalm. And surely, yes, there are terrible things described here, but he would also again be encouraged by the words of the latter part of the psalm. Come, we won't go to it, but Luke 23 and verse 43 is the "Today thou shalt be with me in paradise." I say unto thee today, comma, thou shalt be with me in paradise. And the paradise is an enclosed garden, and again may have reference back to the Song of Solomon, but that clock is ticking by and we need to go on. Mark's record in its chapter 15 and verse 33 records darkness from the 3 o'clock, from the 9th hour of the day. 3 hours of darkness. Now we know what it's like outside there for 3 hours when we get hot. We're talking here of a Middle Eastern sun at its hottest part from midday until 3 o'clock. And surely, brethren and sisters, apart from the symbology that the light of the earth had now been temporarily extinguished, although it would re-emerge, here was an act of mercy, I believe, to keep the heat of the sun away from the sun of righteousness. Do you remember that eclipse 2 or 3 years ago? If you were outside, it went cool, and I believe it would go similarly cool here because the sun was darkened as an act of mercy. Mark 15 and verse 34. Mark 15, verse 34. Verse 33 talks about the darkness for the 3 hours. And at verse 34, the 9th hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And we're still in Psalm 22. But it's in, can we look at it then? Psalm 22 again. I told you to keep a marker, but I haven't. Psalm 22, and we go then into the first verse. "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Verse 2, "O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season I am not silent. But thou art holy, thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in thee." So notice this isn't a negative thing. Jesus is being positive here. He's putting his faith absolutely in the one that has always been with his people. And he had to be forsaken in the sense that he had to be left to die. It's the same word as in Acts, where thou hast not left his soul in hell to see corruption. It's the same word. In other words, he came out of hell. The grave, the forsaking was only for a short time. But forsaken, the psalm clearly says, he was. And so then into, that was Acts chapter 2 and verse 27. "Thou shalt not leave my soul in hell." That's the word. It's the same as we have here. Back into the Gospels, this time John, for the last time. John chapter 19 and verse 30. What a mind our master had. He's been 3 hours or so hanging upon that tree. He's been all through that night of abuse. He's been tortured beyond belief. He's lost a lot of blood. And in verse 28 of John 19, "And after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I thirst." Now he would have been, of course, very thirsty. The Psalms tell us that. But he didn't say, "I thirst," because he was thirsty. "That the scriptures might be fulfilled." There is a clarity of mind, brethren and sisters, after all he had been through. He has come right now to the end of his mortal time, apart from when he came out of the tomb. But he came out now here, and we're back again in Psalm 22. But we'll leave that alone. We also see, can we go to Luke 23 now? Luke 23 and verse 46. Luke 23 and verse 46, where we read, "And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice," which I believe is when he said, "It is finished," which is the quotation from the psalm which he had started. My time's gone, so we can't go there. We then read, "Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit." Can we just go into Psalm 69? I desperately want to go there, but we can only be briefly. Psalm 69. Notice the six times that the word reproach is used. Notice in verse 9, "The zeal of my house hath eaten me up. The reproaches of them that reproach thee are fallen upon me. If thou be the Son of God, save thyself. Others he saved, he cannot save himself." All those reproaches which were thrown in his teeth, he viewed as a reproach to the Father. There's a tremendous exhortation there. But just quickly, verse 20 says, "Reproach hath broken my heart." So it wasn't the physical pain. It was the abuse. It was the mental abuse. Reproach hath broken my heart. And that was then his state. But we go now then finally to Psalm 31. Here is the clarity of mind. In his last gasp, in intense and long pain, he could gather his mind and not only quote a psalm, but think of his resurrection, because Psalm 31 and verse 5 says, "Into thy hand I commit my spirit." That's the quotation. But look at the next bit. "Thou hast redeemed me, O Yahweh, God of truth." And surely those words would be on his lips in the darkness of the tomb 3 days and 3 nights later. And so, yes, we have considered dark and terrible things, but because he was resurrected, brethren and sisters, we too have hope of life. And so, as Brother Alan said, we don't stand here dispensing wisdom, but rather we encourage each other to re-emphasise the importance of this last week, both for the Master and for us, to consider the importance of it for each one of us, for every moment of our lives.